ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is United States against Bartlett. Mr. Simon.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Simon, and I represent defendant appellant John Bartlett in this action. Mr. Bartlett has raised two challenges on appeal. The first is to his conspiracy conviction under Section 241, which defendant Masaryk has joined. And then we also have challenged Mr. Bartlett's sentence, both on procedural grounds and on substantive grounds. I'd like to start with the conspiracy count, if I may. Your Honors, Mr. Bartlett was sentenced to an extra 10 years for consecutive to his 242 sentence for his conspiracy conviction. And in our view, the government has been very explicit, both in the way it tried the case and in its arguments in this appeal, that it takes an extreme position that any time a group of police officers act together in violation of the law, that alone is going to be sufficient enough to infer a conspiracy.
Well, let me just start you out this way. Why couldn't a jury infer agreement from the degree of concerted action? In other words, they all surround the truck. They pulled the victims from the truck after announcing they were police officers. They separated the victims. It took several people to bring Mr. Jew down to the ground and keep him there for the duration of the beating. It seems to be a great deal of coordinated action. And why would that not be enough to infer an agreement?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence
I've struggled with this, so.
I mean, and this is a case that requires a drawing of the line by this court. We understand that. We understand the deference to challenging a conviction on sufficiency of the evidence. But the difference here is, Judge, that the evidence of the concerted conduct isn't in furtherance of the unlawful activity. I mean, the evidence really of the concerted conduct is the separating the two, the surrounding the truck. We wouldn't be here today if that incident ended at that point in time. The beating itself is the violation, and the beating itself is really joint conduct in participation, common participation in the activity. There's no suggestion that there was planning. There's no suggestion, like in the government's cases, where this group was assembled in order to commit a crime. The government's own the testimony that it relied on in its closing arguments emphasized how this was spontaneous, how the defendants rushed out of the house, how someone shouted that no one even knows who, they've taken the badge, and this group moved out.
Let's go get him would be the implication, wouldn't it?
Well, let's go find the badge might be the implication. Let's beat them and deprive them of their civil rights. We submit not.
You do have an attack that went on, it would seem, for 20 to 25 minutes. You believe that that's enough time for them to form an understanding of a joint purpose?
This is one of we've talked about this internally. Is 20 minutes a long time or a short time? I mean, the entire incident lasted from the time Mr. Jude and Mr. Harris entered the house to the time of the arrest of Mr. Jude was a very short period of time. We submit 20 minutes was not enough. And more importantly, Your Honor, there's no evidence that there was an agreement. I mean, I think it's telling in this case where you had two cooperating witnesses who testified for the government, both of whom are alleged to have been members of this conspiracy, neither of whom said, yeah, we all agreed to do this, or someone suggested I would have this role.
You don't have to say it out loud, just do it. If you participate in this thing as a joint venture, you see somebody pounding on you, jump in the egg, say, I'm with your friend, and keep whacking at it, or the complication being the same that I'm with you. Why isn't that a conspiracy?
The difference is there's not an agreement. I mean, that's the cases that
we've... Well, the agreement is implicit, it seems to me, in what you're doing.
Well, if you're going to find that any time a group of people engage in activity together, that that's sufficient to infer a conspiracy where there's no evidence of planning.
Well, they're not just doing something together, that you're watching people commit crimes and you pile in and join with them and become a partner in the crime. If I see somebody robbing a bank and dash in to help them and say, you know, headwalk, I'm joining a conspiracy.
But there's a very clear distinction that this court has made in its prior cases between joining a group that's engaging in unlawful conduct and joining a conspiracy, joining the agreement.
Yeah, but at some stage of the game, it becomes more than just a single act. It goes on and on and on and on.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
But our position is, Judge, that you know, this is like the gang cases. This court has decided these cases, and other circuits have as well. You know, it's pretty well established now that just because a group of people together engage in illegal conduct, even if they're affiliated, even if there's evidence that they, as a part of their training and their culture in that affiliation, will work together, courts have held that that's not enough, that there has to be some independent evidence of planning, of an agreement. I mean, this is a separate crime.
Plan has to be ahead of time. Elaborate, or can it?
It doesn't have to be elaborate, but it has to be.
It has to be
a plan. It has to be an agreement, a mutual meeting of minds to create this. I mean, remember, this is a separate offense. It's a separate crime. The entry into the agreement is a crime in and of itself. We're not talking about the actions. We're talking about the agreement.
I'm fairly familiar with the law of conspiracy.
I'm sure you are, Your Honor.
Why would it not be sufficient that Mr. Spengler announced his purpose and the others then followed him out the door, essentially joining the agreement? You know, Mr. Spengler noticed that his badge was missing and announces this to the assembled group.
Well, the conspiracy that was charged here and the conspiracy that supports this conviction is a conspiracy to deprive the defendants of the their civil rights. It's a specific intent conspiracy that requires an agreement to do something unlawful. Going out to the car to try to retrieve a badge isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honors, I would like to talk about sentencing, but I've hit my rebuttal time, and if it's okay with the court, I'd like to reserve the last couple minutes to talk about our sentencing argument.
If you want to rebut anything on sentencing, you'd better make an opening argument about sentencing, because otherwise the prosecutor will just ignore the subject.
Fair enough. I just want to know two things. One, the disparity in this sentence is significant. We've argued that both from a procedural standpoint, the district court judge didn't adequately explain why these defendants should get such a long sentence compared to similarly situated defendants in other cases. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, this district judge did not follow this court's precedent on sentencing outside of guidelines. Very clear under the Gall case and under this court's precedence that the steps the court must follow are number one, calculate the guidelines range, number two, apply the 3553A factors to make an individualized determination, and then number three, if you're going to sentence outside the guidelines, you have to explain why you're doing it. And not just explain why your sentence is what it is, but explain why you are not going to take into account the factors that the sentencing guideline, with the empirical evidence and the experience that the commission has available to it, determined was appropriate for similar sentences. And I think there's no dispute that this judge didn't follow those precedents.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kinsler.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Kinsler. I represent Andrew Spengler, and I have more to say than I'm sure time will permit. Please forgive me if I speak too quickly. I have a number of issues I'd like to address, first of which is the Court's refusal to permit cross-examination of government witness John Clousing and witness Schauble regarding the interesting means and methods and the way that the government was dealing with them in terms of their plea agreement.
Help me with this.
Yes.
What would it have added to the cross of Clothing and Schauble to allow the evidence regarding the polygraphs. Spengler's point seems to be more about the government's motives than about the motives of Clausing and Schaubel.
I don't disagree entirely. What would it have added? The government asked, "You're a big fat liar, aren't you? You've lied a bunch of times before, haven't you?" The fact that we got up there and repeated that for stress is not the point. There was only one pillar on which their credibility stood, and that was the fact that they had a deal with the government. And the nature of that deal was what was at issue in this case. That deal was the only thing that lent either of these two witnesses credibility. If we were not allowed to cross-examine these people about the unusual circumstances in which this deal was made, and not given the opportunity to show that this was an illusory agreement. The government characterized this as only if you tell the truth. But that's not what the government's deal was. They were not going to polygraph them afterwards to see if they had testified truthfully. They polygraphed them after they told the first story and lied. With respect to Clausing, they polygraphed him after he told a second story that they were unhappy with. When he told a third version, they were happy. They stopped polygraphing him. All Mr. Clausing had to do was get up on the stand, testify consistent with his last statement, and the government was going to be satisfied. Although I am not going to, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a poet, I don't know what the truth is with a capital T. I live in the world of proof, not truth. But in this particular instance, the government held out their credibility as resting on they must give truthful testimony, and that is not what that plea agreement was about. That was not the means by which the government used to determine what statement they would use, and it was not consistent with how they were rewarded with 1/6. Let me remind the court, Mr. Clausing is the one who cut Mr. Harris in the face, more or less on his own after John Bartlett had left. Mr. Schaubel was the one who stomped 3 times on the head of Frank Jude, probably causing the majority of serious injuries in this case. And yet, the deal with the government was somehow immune, and the circumstances were immune from being dealt with. That goes to the center of their credibility because it is the sole pillar that they that their credibility rested on. That's why we think it is a fundamental violation of the confrontation right. I think I've probably used as much time as I should for that issue, unless there are any other questions from the panel. I'd like to next address the lesser included instruction issue, if I may. The government, in its response, raised concerns about using an acquittal as evidence that there was a factual basis for a middle ground between the felony and an acquittal. Those cases are interesting for the following reason. They both involve examples where there is no middle ground. One involves a torture homicide where somebody was taped up and tortured in various ways and then killed. The defense was alibi. There's no middle ground. One can't argue for a lesser included reckless. I recklessly tied someone up with duct tape and tortured them. They were either there and did it intentionally, or they weren't. This is a case where, and it may be verboten to bring it up, there was an acquittal in state court under the same set of very, very, very similar set of witnesses. It is not a stretch of the imagination to believe that, given the testimony that by the government's own witnesses, that everything was appropriate up to a certain point, that it was a little bit out of hand but not inappropriate, given that there was testimony that Mr. Spengler approached, spoke with Mr. Jude, conversed with him before Mr. Jude impersonated an officer, went back into the house several times to look for his badge. There is not, you know, if one cherry picks enough, one will find a lot of damning evidence that Mr. Spengler deserves to be punished for. On the other hand, one can just as easily cherry pick, and I think to some extent that's what a jury does, one can just as easily cherry pick the evidence that is mitigated, the evidence that shows that he may have conspired to violate someone's civil rights but didn't necessarily cause injury and wasn't reason that the injuries that occurred were not reasonably foreseeable. The idea that a lesser included could not be given is more or less the court imposing its view that Mr. Spengler could not have been acquitted at all because the evidence was so overwhelming. And in a case that the government, frankly, had to try a second time, that's not overwhelming.
You mean two different governments tried it?
Yes, I do. And I understand that
it
is
Rodney
not...
Rodney King had the same problem.
I'm sorry?
The prosecutors in the Rodney King case had the same thing, where the state jury acquit. One in Miami was exactly the same thing. Police officers were acquitted by a state, convicted in the federal.
Yes, but in this particular case, I'm not arguing that there's anything inappropriate about that. What I'm saying is that reasonable people could look at the same set of facts and find that there was less than the felony conviction, less than violation of civil rights, and that denial of a lesser included instruction, which is reversible error if there is any factual basis for granting that. I'd like to talk about the disjunctive instruction. The court, I'm afraid I have more than I can possibly address. I hope the court will give me just a few seconds of extra leeway.
Well, we've read your briefs, so you know you've got that much going on.
Well, I appreciate that. I do want to make sure, though, the disjunctive instruction, there's no confusion in this case, says the government. Well, if the judge was concerned about Mr. Harris's other conviction coming in being confusing or wasting time, not that it would take more than 10 seconds, if the court was so concerned that Mr. Jude's prior two convictions, one of which was for escape from custody, would have confused the jury or taken too long. I'm shocked that all of a sudden, when it came to a 12-day trial with more than two dozen witnesses, after an extensive history of this case and multiple allegations, lots of contradictory evidence, that a jury couldn't possibly be confused as to whether or not Mr. Spengler violated the civil rights of Mr. Jude or vice versa. I see that the white light is on, and I should probably sit down quickly. I do want to say, though, that we find that the sentence was utterly unreasonable and that it was preordained the moment Mr. Spengler walked into court. The other two defendants had already been sentenced, and I think that the court simply cherry-picked those factors that would support the sentence that was pre-decided. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Habermill.
Good morning. I'm Alan Habermill. I represent Daniel Masaryk. From our point of view, this case is about identification, and that's the primary issue raised in the brief, and I wish to argue. If ever there was a factual situation that could be more conducive to false identifications, to mistakes about who's doing what, I can't imagine it.
I can. It's really easy to imagine it. How many people in total identified your client as among the assailants?
At the federal trial, six, if I recall correctly.
Right. Well, I trust you're familiar with our opinion in U.S. against Williams, which said, regardless of the social science research showing high error rates in individual stranger identifications, there are no data on multiple independent identifications. Right? You're using a stripe of social science research that simply isn't applicable to multiple identification situations. So we've held at least twice, and you've got a big burden to deal with that, and your brief doesn't try to. It doesn't try to say we've got good social science data about multiple independent identifications.
The brief, I believe, does address those issues in the following manner. First of all, each one of those identifications is, after all, an independent identification as to the person making it. Each of those people was subject to various of the factors which, in fact, would be conducive to having made a misidentification.
I don't think you understand the point of decisions like Williams and Newsom, which is assume each identification has a 1 in 3 chance of being erroneous. The probability that all six are erroneous is 1/3 to the 6th power, which is infinitesimal.
The problem with that, again, is assuming that you multiply them. They are, in fact, independent. Each of them, again, has its own probability, and I think the jury should be allowed to evaluate each of them. They only reinforce each other if you assume that they're accurate. If, however, they're not, they don't.
Will we find anywhere in the record pictures of Masaryk and Lemke? I know Lemke was brought to the stand so the jurors could see the resemblance, but was this image somehow preserved for the record?
To my knowledge, no. I understand the point of that question, but to my knowledge, no. The problem, again, with the identification from our point of view, is that, in fact, by not allowing any kind of evidence to be presented to the jury to attack, for instance, the proposition the court has just made, Mr. Masaryk was denied his opportunity to present a defense. Talking about whether identifications are or are not reliable is a statement of fact about the existence of certain factors in the real world. It's not a legal issue. And it is important, I think, to make that distinction, because when you have issues of fact and there is a person who does have something relevant to say about resolving them, I don't believe it's sufficient to simply make statistical analyses in that sense. The jury isn't being asked to decide on a statistical basis what are the odds of these people being right or wrong. They are being asked to look at what each person's testimony is and the circumstances under which it was made and decide if they're right or wrong. I thought you were about to ask me a question, by mistake. What you have here is a situation where simple cross-examination is pointless because the people simply repeat what they said. Being dead certain isn't the same as being dead right. They can often simply be dead wrong. And I don't think there's any clearer illumination of that than what happened in this case. Under essentially similar charges with essentially similar identical overlapping witnesses, the first trial resulted in acquittal. You have expert testimony, and you're allowed to have the testimony of corroborating witnesses. After all, the six who identified him weren't the only people who testified at the first trial. Other people testified that he didn't do it. If we're going to start multiplying, then all of a sudden all we're doing is saying, well, the odds of six people being right is better than the odds of three people right. The last time I did a state court trial and had multiple witnesses, the instruction was given very directly, you don't decide who's right and wrong by the simple number of witnesses on each side. One witness may be right, and the other six could all be wrong. 20 of them could be wrong. It isn't just a simple question of counting heads. A jury should be entitled to have the information they need to evaluate each one of those witnesses in their turn. Each was subject to different kinds of problems with their testimony. Several of the people, after all, who identified Masaryk at the second trial did not at the first trial. And again, that's one of those problems with trying to do just a statistical analysis, because memories are malleable. These things are not constant over time. What we're not asking the court to do is to permit an identification expert to get up and say, this witness is incredible, this identity is credible, this one is not. All we're asking the court to do is to catch up to what we believe is the current state of factual scientific affairs, to say that there is something helpful for an expert to say to a jury, and that the expert can identify not just what the factors are. I can cross-examine someone and say, was it dark? How far away were you? How long did you have a chance to see them?
Did you ask the district judge to instruct the jury on the state of the scientific knowledge?
The instruction that the district judge was willing to give was the standard instruction on ID. There was no basis.
Please deal with my question. Did you ask the district judge to give an instruction on the state of the scientific knowledge?
We didn't do the trial. To my knowledge and from reviewing the record, no, there was not such a specific request made. In response to that, there was no factual basis in the record to ask for such instruction because the judge had already denied the defendant the opportunity to put the knowledge in. I do not believe a judge can...
There are ways to show knowledge other than expert witnesses. Now, your brief cites the Hill case a lot. Surely you're aware of the fact that the panel in Hill suggested that this information should come in via instructions from the judge and not via expert witnesses.
The problem with that approach, in my opinion, is that it essentially constitutes the judge taking judicial notice of certain factual matters. For instance, the state of scientific research on a point, and I do not believe that's an appropriate topic for a judge to take judicial notice of, because it's clearly capable of controversy. That is not something... It's not like what color
there's any controversy among social scientists about the proposition you sought to have established. I don't think there are any witnesses who would disagree with the fact that eyewitness testimony is extremely chancy, and that there are certain things like being a stranger and cross-racial identification and so on that reduce the reliability of eyewitness testimony. It's not only well established in the literature, it's well established in our cases. Why does one need an expert to show what is, I think, pretty well understood?
To relate the general propositions to the specific facts of the case in the sense of trying to at least refer to the specific circumstances of distance, time, cross-racial identity, whatever the issues are, and to explain the basis for that so it isn't simply the judge saying words in an instruction. A defendant's entitled to put on a factual defense, not merely get an instruction from a judge on such a matter. And I believe it, he ends up fighting with one hand tied behind his back when he's not permitted to do that.
You're into your rebuttal time, you know, sir.
Yes, I see that. Very quickly, the other hand that got tied behind his back was the refusal to permit the hearsay testimony of the previously examined but currently unavailable witness, all of which would have exculpated Mr. Masaryk. It was only his witnesses that got indicted, that got made unavailable, and suddenly the trial went from an actual contest to something quite different, something quite one-sided. And the combined effect of those two was to completely obliterate any chance of presenting an actual defense other than just getting up and saying he didn't do it. And I will stop at this point. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Habermel. Mr. Phillips.
May it please the Court. Unless the Court has a preference, I think I will just proceed through the issues in the order in which they've been raised today, beginning with the conspiracy issue.
Then let me start you out, please. When was the agreement formed? We know the group's purpose was to retrieve the badge and perhaps punish those who they believed had taken the badge. But that is not necessarily an illegal goal. And it's not until they begin to go about the goal in an illegal fashion that a potentially criminal act would arise. What is the best evidence that the government has had that they agreed to retrieve the badge by criminal means?
I think the best evidence is their own actions. You clearly have, you know, in the brief we sort of lay out a wide-angle view, starting with when they come out and surround the truck and going through the vandalizing of the vehicle.
I think I recited those.
Right.
So.
Right. I think the best evidence is there's a period during the middle of that where you have, it's a period of several minutes, probably if you look at the 911 calls on the transcript, it's certainly 6 minutes, probably more, particularly construing the evidence in light most favorable to the government, where you have the defendants working together to beat information out of a suspect. I think particularly in light of the standard of review on a sufficiency challenge, that is more than enough by itself. I think to the extent there was any debate about the propriety or the reasonableness of their actions, I think you can draw, I'm not sure the court needs to draw a line, but I think you can draw a line at the point at which they've surrounded the truck and removed everyone, searched the truck, and still found nothing. Now, we would take the position that it was unreasonable before that because you don't seize a truck by holding a knife to the tire and punching out a headlight and rocking it back and forth. But even if you want to say it's debatable during the early part of the seizure, by the time everyone's out of the truck, they've been separated and searched, and the truck has been searched, any argument about reasonableness or legality of their actions is gone at that point. And they then proceed to work together to beat information out of a suspect. And I think that's all we need in this case.
Is there sufficient evidence of a conspiracy in every instance of mob action? Let's talk about the Bulls, and the Bulls win the pennant, and a drunken crowd overturns a car on the street, you know, during the celebration. Is that a conspiracy to overturn a car? It requires concerted action. No one person certainly can turn a car over.
Oh, yeah, they can.
You know such different people than I have ever met.
Our chief can do it.
Admittedly, Your Honor, that type of scenario would fall closer to the line. But I think you can draw a clear distinction between that and what we have in this case, which is essentially an interrogation. That's quite different from a mob surrounding a car and overturning it, you know, in the process of a celebration. This is off-duty officers who put themselves on duty and work together to interrogate and beat information out of a suspect. And I think that requires quite a bit more coordination and consistency of purpose than simply overturning a truck or a car. And I think, again, when you sort of pan out and look at take a wider view of the facts, there is considerable evidence where they surrounded the truck, they separated, they removed the occupants, they separated them, they searched the truck, and only when that was not successful did they begin to beat and interrogate a suspect, and then they vandalized his car afterwards. I think certainly when you put it all together, I don't think there's any doubt that there's sufficient evidence. I mean, this court has said, and we note this, I believe it's at page 27 of our brief, that it overturns the record only when it can, or excuse me, only overturn the verdict only when the record contains no evidence, regardless of how it is weighed, from which the jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There certainly is evidence from which the jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Would we have a different case if Spengler had simply gone after Mr. Jude and Mr. Harris without telling his guests about the missing badge, if the guests joined the fray without knowing why Spengler was attacking the victims? Would that be conspiracy? And just out of curiosity, do we know what happened to the badge?
No, to take those questions in reverse order, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that would indicate what happened to the badge. No badge was ever recovered. The question with regard to whether Spengler going out, if I understand the hypothetical, he goes out alone and then is joined by the others?
Yeah, he doesn't tell his guests. Then they join the fray without knowing why he's attacking his victims.
Right. Admittedly, that would be closer to the line. That would actually be closer to Lyons, which is the district court case that Bartlett relies upon. But I think even in that case, I'm not sure that it's determinative that he tells them at the outset. I think that's certainly a helpful fact for the government. But once they're out there and they're working together to beat the information out of the suspect, again, I think that's more than enough. With regard to the cross-examination of Clausing and Schauble, as we noted at the outset, this is an abuse of discretion standard. That's laid out at, I believe, pages 61 and 62 of our brief. This court has said that you don't get to cross-examine in whatever way and to whatever extent you may wish. The core question is whether there was sufficient information for the jury to appraise the witness. And there's no question that was satisfied in this case. There was ample evidence to call into question the credibility of both men, and the district court was certainly within its right to exclude the evidence of polygraph under 403. And I think it's particularly I think that principle is particularly true in this case, where you're talking about polygraph evidence, and there's a heightened chance that the jury will misunderstand or misuse the evidence. With regard to Mr. Spangler's argument regarding the lesser included offense, the standard is very, very clearly laid out in this court. A defendant is entitled to a lesser included offense instruction only if the evidence would permit a rational jury to find guilt under the lesser charge and to acquit on the charge alleged. That simply could not have happened in this case. As we set forth at page 80 of our brief, the elements at issue are bodily injury and the use, attempted use, or threatened use of a dangerous weapon. There's no question both of those elements are present here. No rational jury could have determined that could have convicted only on the misdemeanor count, only on a misdemeanor count of 242 as opposed to a felony count. And this court has said in Crisman, which is cited at page 79 of our brief, a verdict on the lesser offense must be plausible as well as rational. It's not either plausible or rational in this case. With regard to the impeachment of Mr. Jude and the convictions that were at issue, we sent a letter to the court earlier this week. I just want to quickly make the argument. There's no question that the convictions that were excluded were at least 10 years old. It certainly fell within the court's right to exclude that under 403, and it even if the court were to disagree with that, there's no question the error was harmless. There's nothing in either of their testimonies that is necessary to affirm the convictions.
Could we talk about Mr. Bartlett's sentence? Because where in the record does the court give a reason for exceeding the guidelines on Mr. Bartlett's sentence. He doesn't seem to realize he's going over the the judge didn't seem to realize that he was going over the guidelines until the government points it out to him. And after that, he still doesn't give any rationale.
To be clear, Your Honor, we would concede there was no specific mention of why he went above the guidelines. Our position is twofold. One, the explanation itself is certainly adequate. What the district court didn't do, and what we would concede he did not do, is he didn't specifically label or designate part of that explanation to explain why he was going above the guidelines. And under 3553C2, he should have done that.
So doesn't Mr. Bartlett have to be remanded for a new sentencing hearing?
No, Your Honor. This court's case law is very clear, and we set this forth in our brief. It's at roughly pages 102 to 103. This court, if you have a procedural objection to the adequacy of the explanation given by a district court judge, you must object at the time. If you don't, it's either waived or forfeited. Some of the language in the cases is somewhat inconsistent. There's no question there was no objection in this case. So it likely was waived. At a minimum, it certainly was forfeited, in which case this court would review only under plain error.
Right.
And he would have to show under plain error that it affected substantial rights. In the sentencing context, that means he has to show that he would have received a different sentence. And that certainly can't be done in this case. The district court was very clear in saying he thought Bartlett was the worst of the actors, that he deserved a sentence higher than the 188 months that was given to Mazarik and Spangler. And the district court also was very clear, as you noted, at the end, once the government brought it to his attention, in saying that he intended to go above the guidelines and intended to give 208 months. If I may, there's nothing in the record that specifically explains why the district court was confused, and I want to make that clear. The government had asked for a higher guideline range. The district court, it was a grouping, an argument with regard to how it was grouped, and the district court rejected that argument. It's possible he was confused because he was thinking about the higher range. We don't know. I want to be very clear. That's not in the record. That is one potential explanation for the confusion on the part of the district court. But again, there's no question that there was no objection, and this court's case law is very clear on that. One just point of clarification I wanted to make for the record. On page 31, note 15, it's a long string cite in our brief. This deals with the conspiracy issue. At the very end of that string cite, we say that Officer Kammermeyer was instructed to search the truck. In reviewing the trial testimony in preparation for oral argument, I realized earlier in her testimony she offers contradictory testimony on that point. I don't think it matters. It's one of many cites that we offer, and it's obviously the court would construe it in the light most favorable to the government anyways, but I just wanted to note that for the record. Be more than happy to answer any other questions the court may have or address any other issues the court would like to discuss. Otherwise, we are content to rest on the arguments in our brief.
If let's just say that we eliminated the eyewitness testimony about Mr. Masaryk, all of which he claims is tainted, what would be left? What's the best evidence against him other than those eyewitnesses?
I'm sorry, if we eliminate all six of the witnesses against him? His conviction is based largely on the eyewitness testimony. The other thing I would say, what would be left is his own testimony. He took the stand and put his credibility at issue. And to the extent the court is concerned about this issue, I would encourage the court to review his testimony. It's at pages 1949 to 2012 of the trial transcript. And I think when you read it, it's pretty clear that he wasn't – I mean, let me back up. I guess I should say, when you read it, I think you'll come away with the same impression I did, which is he wasn't convicted because of a lack of expert testimony or a lack of semi-corroborative co-conspirator testimony. I think he was convicted in large part because he took the stand, put his credibility at issue, and told a story that just wasn't believable, and the jury saw that. So even if you took away the eyewitness testimony, he still took the stand, put his credibility at issue, and the jury obviously didn't believe him. And I think one point on that, if I may, Your Honor, the district court also didn't believe him. At page 9 of the sentencing transcript, which is record number 243 at the district court level, the district court is at this point in the transcript ruling on the obstruction of justice enhancement. And obviously, there's a different standard at sentencing than there would be at trial, but the district court says, it is impossible for me to conclude that Mr. Mazarek was testifying truthfully regarding his whereabouts during this brawl, this attack. The district court obviously knew about the expert testimony, knew about all the other testimony, still concluded that it was impossible to credit Mazarek's testimony. So I think, to take Your Honor's question, even if you cut everything else out, his testimony itself wasn't credible, and that can be considered as evidence against him.
You know, the court was so concerned that if Mr. Mazarek presented an expert on eyewitness identification, that the government would want to present one too. Had the government identified an expert for this area?
I was not involved with the trial. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. If the court would like to know, I could certainly consult with our trial attorneys and send a follow-up letter. I don't know the answer off the top of my head whether they identified anyone or not. I know that was part of the district court's concern. I'm not sure that anyone had been identified, but if you'd like, I can follow up with the court on that issue.
You were really talking about a few hours in a 10-day trial. What difference would that have made?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at this in the context of a 10-day trial. There are lots of issues like this that come up, and lots of them would add time. And the district court has to draw – I'm sorry, not issues exactly like this, but the district court has to make a lot of determinations regarding timing and that sort of thing. And I think this is an area where we defer to district judges, and particularly
I'm
in a case –
I'm smiling because I was a district judge for 8 years. I know all about it.
Right. And so I think that this is something where this certainly falls within the district court's discretion in terms of managing the trial and managing the presentation of the evidence. I don't think – particularly, as I said, given the clarity of this court's case law. And I would also note the additional steps that exist in this case. You know, this court has said, I believe it was in Hall, it laid out additional factors for the district court to consider. This is at pages roughly 44 to 47 of our brief. There were cautionary instructions given in this case that came straight out of this court's pattern jury instructions. There was ample corroborative evidence, and there was ample cross-examination, and those are the three factors that this court looks to, even apart from its general disfavor for this type of testimony. All three of those are hit in this case. So I think, given all of that, the district court was well within its discretion to exclude this testimony. Unless the court has any other questions, we will rest on the arguments made in our brief.
And thank you, Mr. Phillips.
We would ask the court to affirm the judgments below.
Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two quick points. On the conspiracy claim, we think that the cases are very helpful to the court in drawing the line here, what's sufficient to support the independent conspiracy argument. The cases we cited, while we recognize are not binding on this court, we think are helpful and very factually similar. Mr. Phillips noted that the Lyons case, apparently conceding that it was correctly decided, although in a civil context, that there was insufficient evidence to support conspiracy, said that the difference was that there wasn't a common purpose there. But I think if you read that case, it's at least it appears to me as if the common purpose was sort of an anti-homosexual sentiment that were comments made before the fight, not really significantly different than the let's get the badge kinds of comments that the government relies on. So we think the cases are helpful. We think that Velazquez case that the government relies on is very helpful by contrast, where there's very specific evidence of specific planning and coordination in advance. On the sentencing point, we don't think it's waived. We don't think there's an obligation to waive under this object to that issue under this court's precedent. The cases the government cites are pre-Booker, pre-Gall. They involve the right to have your sentence explained to you under the guidelines. They don't involve the right to have the district court explain why he's departing from the guidelines. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Simon. Mr. Kinsler, anything further?
Yes, please. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, I want to respond to I think the government's position that these errors that we've alleged were harmless. In one case, we've got witnesses who have either one prior conviction or three. That's an awful lot. Or zero prior convictions or one. These are the victims in a civil rights case. Their testimony is crucial to the government. It cannot be ignored as an important aspect of their testimony. Secondly, with respect to the co-conspirator statements of Mr. Schauble and Mr. Clausing, both of whom had a deal to cooperate with the government, both of whom testified pursuant to that deal and received a massive benefit in that bargain. These are the two co-conspirators who testified. The notion that the ability not to cross-examine them properly on the one thing that gave them credibility, which we say was an illusory agreement, the idea that that is not harmless is I cannot agree by any means. Cross-examination on the polygraph is absolutely crucial. And Judge Rovner, you said, but isn't it about the government's perception? This is a contract between a witness and the government. The government only gives up its side of the deal if it believes the conditions are met. So the government's position is part of the contract. That contract is the basis for their credibility. So yes, it may have something to do with the government's perception. And finally, with respect to sentencing, it is difficult for me, and if I had 10 hours, I could not sufficiently go through all the different things that I would like to with respect to sentencing. Suffice it to say this.
30 seconds.
If the offense here, where they were off duty, surprised, believed there was a theft, had been drinking, it was spontaneous, short-lived, no history of violence, no planning. Under those circumstances.
If you would just remain at the podium, that would help.
Thank you. Under those circumstances, if that deserves three-quarters of the maximum sentence possible, what do you do with co-conspirators who are planning, co-conspirators who are on duty, co-conspirators who have a...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Habermel, anything further?
Yes. With respect to the government's point about corroboration that only exists, if you accept as a fact that what they're saying is true, because the only corroboration offered was other eyewitnesses. There's no independent corroboration in the sense of some kind of physical evidence of any kind. And so, once again, it's a circular argument. And with regard to the point of there being multiple witnesses, again, they don't corroborate themselves in the sense of being truly independent. As we point out in the brief, all of them, every single witness was shown a photo lineup, and none of them initially identified Ms. Sarek. It was only later, after they had been exposed either to media coverage, which is a common thread then, it's no longer independent, they're all seeing the same thing, or they've talked with other witnesses, they finally become more convinced, and then they finally do identify him. And that's exactly the kind of thing an expert should have been allowed to come and explain to the jury. Not just the actual physical acts of perception or even of memory, but how memories can get confabulated as time goes on, how the brain doesn't necessarily distinguish the source of the information anymore, how people, once again, can become dead certain and yet dead wrong. And the mere fact that there's a large number of them doing that at the same time doesn't
counsel.
Change it. Thank you.
Cases taken under advisement. And Mr. Simon, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The court will now be in a brief recess before calling the next case.